Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. If you're applying to medical school in 2022 to start medical school in 2023, join me Wednesday or Thursday, Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern or Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern at premedworkshop.com. Go register today. I'm going to show you how to tell your story in your application. Again, that's premedworkshop.com. If you are applying to medical school in 2022, be there or be square. The pre-med year, session number 256. Hello and welcome to the three-time Academy Award-nominated podcast, The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to the pre-med years. I'm excited for today's episode announcing a brand new medical school. Now, the guest I have today has had a vision of what medicine should be for a long time. And now, as the dean of the Carl, Illinois College of Medicine, Dr. King Lee can now put that vision into practice as the dean of a medical school that is trying to merge technology and engineering into the medical curriculum. And we dive into why the medical school came about, what his vision for the school is, how he is hoping that with the curriculum and the full-time faculty there, thinking through all these problems with the students, helping them think through these problems, he is going to talk about the vision that he sees for the future of graduates of Carl, Illinois College of Medicine. King, thank you for joining me here on the pre-med years. I'm excited to be able to talk to you. How are you doing today?
I'm great, as usual.
How does a man named King go on to be a physician? What led you down this path to be a doctor?
Well, I think really a merging of different impacts. So from my upbringing, we are taught to really the goal in life is to make positive impact to society. And as I look around different careers, I decided that being a physician can certainly make a positive impact to society. And at the same time, I was very attracted to engineering and technology. And when I learned that you can apply the skills in engineering and technology to really improve healthcare, and my mind was made up.
What did that look like for you? Because I think a lot of people, and this will lead into our discussion later on, but a lot of people, when they think about medicine, that additional piece of engineering technology doesn't come into play. Why was that kind of at the beginning of your thoughts?
Well, if you really look at the tremendous development in medicine, a lot of them are actually stimulated by technology. For example, right, the development of the CT scanner and the MR scanner fundamentally change the way we take care of a lot of patients. So when I was in college, the CT scanner was just introduced. And that is a merging of a lot of engineering and technology, but have tremendous applications in medicine. And imagine you do not have to open up, right, a patient's body to look inside, and already can make the diagnosis by just taking images, right, inside the body. So when I was in medical school, I was deciding on different specialties, and that's when MRI just got started. So that's why, you know, I got attracted to the discipline of radiology and become a radiologist, because that's the discipline at that time that I felt really married engineering and technology and medicine the most. And I never regretted that decision. And now I'm the dean of a College of Medicine that is the world's first engineering-focused College of Medicine. So it really it exemplifies how someone in the pre-med year can just follow their passion, and everything can work out.
I think it's kind of ironic that technology drew you to radiology, and we're in a phase now, in a time where with machine learning and artificial intelligence, radiology might be one of the first specialties that's very affected by the new technologies, to where we don't need as many radiologists as we have now.
Right. I mean, I think that's something that the whole healthcare industry is going to face, right? If you look at how technology and engineering has transformed many industries, and you can say, for example, in the retail industry, electronic retail has replaced a lot of the brick and mortar stores, right? So Imagine the day that driverless car become the dominant mode of transportation, right? Then how about the taxi drivers, the bus drivers, and so on, right? So we shouldn't be afraid of the impact of technology and engineering, but we should stay ahead of the curve and turn the table around and say, how can we leverage engineering technology to improve healthcare in a way that can increase quality, decrease cost, and also increase accessibility, right? So for example, if you use radiology as an example, imagine the day you need very little human intervention in terms of interpreting the images, that would democratize, right, the availability of very high quality diagnostic tools to many more people. Mm-hmm. So we should welcome that change rather than being afraid of that change.
I very much welcome that change. It's the radiologists that are making $300,000 a year that are scared of that change.
Well, the way that physicians that can deal with this change is to say, hey, if this is the part of the job that can be replaced by a machine, what part of the job cannot be replaced by machine, right? So, and that doesn't apply just to radiology, but all parts of medicine, right? So imagine what we can do in a ambulatory clinic, right? Think about it. You know, most of the diagnostic tools we use in an ambulatory clinic are very old. Think of a stethoscope that was discovered 200 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. An otoscope is about 180 years old. So a lot of those technology can be replaced by modern day technology that are more accurate, right? And at the same time can be done remotely, right? So if you also put in other types of remote sensing and also ways to capture the history, you may be able to replace most of what we do in the ambulatory clinic and not really need a physician to do that. So if you think about that, right? Radiology may not be the only discipline that would be impacted. In fact, a lot of the practice of medicine can be revolutionized.
Yeah.
Using technology and engineering approaches.
I'm excited to see that future where that Star Trek future where we have the tricorder that just waves over you and we have a diagnosis and you just jump into a pod and you get your treatment and it'll be very interesting.
I think that's a progression, but if you ask people, right, if you walk into a doctor's office today versus 30 years ago, what technology has changed significantly? I would say that not a lot, right? You still use the stethoscope, you still use the ophthalmoscope, you still use the otoscope. Those hasn't changed, right? So, but if you look at the rest of the society, right? You know, 20 years ago, you don't even have a smartphone, right? And Google now really is the dominant way we get information, and we can get a lot of information very quickly. And that is really different than when I first started the practice of medicine, when you have to carry a lot of information in your head because it's hard, right, to take up that information. So the whole process of training and practice has to follow, right, the changes in technology, but we are not really changing it in a way that is keeping up with the changes in technology and also with society.
So King, as you were practicing as a physician, you had this passion for technology. How were you utilizing that passion in your practice?
Well, so imagine I do so-called the tripartite mission, right? So I was always in academic medicine. So technology really was a way that we can use leverage to improve not just patient care, but also education. And of course, in research, right? So that all that have been affected in, by the rapid changes in technology. And that brings us to today, right? So that's why, you know, I truly believe, together with many people, that the educational mission and the clinical mission have been falling tremendously behind modern-day development in engineering and technology. And mostly because of the skewed incentives that we have in the healthcare industry. So imagine, right, in all other industry, technology has been able to drive up quality and drive down cost. Whereas in the healthcare industry, technology has been blamed for driving up costs instead of driving down costs, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to look at the reason why, right? And how, you know, the next generation of physician innovators has to become the catalyst so that engineering and technology can be used just like any other industry to drive up quality and drive down cost and increase accessibility.
I had this discussion recently with a interventional cardiologist on my other podcast, Specialty Stories, and he was talking about there's a threat of decreasing reimbursements from Medicare and Medicaid. And I asked that specific question. I said, well, don't you think the technologies that you're using have been out long enough now that they're getting cheaper? Why wouldn't they reduce the cost? And he's like, well, there's still physicians that are getting up in the middle of the night and doing the work. And so there's always that argument of, well, I still need my pay.
Right. So if you really look at what drives the cost up, right? The three major things, especially in the U.S. healthcare system. One is labor costs, right? Mm-hmm. The second is drug costs. And third, especially in this country, is administrative costs because we have so many different types of insurance company and so on. You need to do all types of different billings because of the different reimbursement schemes and so on, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, to the extent that we can actually decrease the labor cost, using engineering and technology, you can help drive down the cost, right? So a lot of the tasks that we are using humans to do, especially now, right? You have doctors that are spending hours just entering data into the electronic health record, right? Imagine all that can be replaced. Then you can actually provide more person-to-person care, but at the same time, drive down the cost. So a lot of the research that has been done in the past in healthcare is mostly disease-oriented, right? Imagine another way of treating a particular disease and not really in the process, improving the process of healthcare delivery, right? That's why you see bigger and better and more expensive machines in the hospitals, but very little improvement in the ambulatory care environment, right? Which is really unfortunate because that's where you can actually impact a lot more patients.
Yeah.
And very good preventive care, right? Imagine if I can develop a kiosk where you have very minimal personnel requirement, but can deliver the same quality or even higher quality care than what you can get in an ambulatory clinic. Don't you think the accessibility and the affordability of healthcare would improve?
I would hope so.
Yes. I mean, yeah. I think that's the driving force, right? Is to re-look at how we do things now and say, how can technology and engineering be deployed to improve things so that we can get higher quality and lower costs and higher accessibility?
I love that thinking. I'm a very technically oriented person, and I've always been kind of an outside-the-box thinker. The problem with that in medicine is that that's not how students are taught. But the Carl Illinois College of Medicine is changing all of that, or is hoping to change all of
Absolutely.
That. Talk about the brainchild. Whose brainchild was this design of a medical school?
Right. I think it's really a collective effort, right? So I think the concept of having an engineering-focused College of Medicine really was developed when the previous chancellor here, Dr. Phyllis Weiss, commissioned this strategic plan. And when they compare this particular institution to others, they find that the major difference is this institution had tremendous engineering technology, and in fact, it's strong across the board. This is a truly comprehensive university, and especially, you know, the College of Engineering has been strong for years and years. So if you look at the competitive advantage, you know, if they have to add another school of medicine, you know, it makes sense to really do something fundamentally different and have high impact. And then, you know, comes the idea of marrying engineering with medicine. So how does it manifest in terms of implementation? And that's when my team comes in, right? And as you say, if you really want to build an engineering-focused College of Medicine, how would you design it so that you can make biggest positive impact to the society, and not just regionally, nationally, but globally? So that's how we position this new College of Medicine.
I think one of the fears for, if I were to picture myself as a pre-med student again, knowing what I know about the process and residencies and everything else, one of the biggest fears that I would see with a new school like this, with such grand hopes and what they want to accomplish, is as a student and somebody who's going to apply to residencies, I'm still being judged on the basics, right? Step one and step two. How are you hoping to accomplish preparing students for the standard academic kind of boxes that we have to put every student in, but also adding all of this extra with the technology, the engineering-based side of things as well?
Well, I think that's a major misconception that most people have about our curriculum. We are actually not adding, we are substituting. So imagine the way you learn about cardiovascular disease in the old way of teaching, right? So you have to memorize a lot of stuff because a lot of stuff cannot be derived from first principles, right? Mm-hmm. So you say, hey, you know, why do plaques form in the branching points of vessels? So instead of, you know, just telling you the fact, we will start with fluid dynamics, right? So you understand the shear forces will be highest in the branching points, and especially if you form a small plaque, then there will be even more turbulence, and that will cause even more, right, damage to the area. So that type of understanding allow you to not memorize stuff, right? So the same thing, if you actually try to understand microbiology, the way we used to do is to memorize every single organism, whether it's gram-positive, gram-negative, right? What antibiotics they will respond to, what type of disease they would cause, and so on. But if I ask you a question, right, if you have a new emerging disease, what type of new intervention you would need to do to decrease the damage of that emerging disease, how do you even go about doing that, right? Mm-hmm. So we will introduce the concept of mathematical modeling, right, understanding the basic concepts of what factors need to be, right, thought through in determining, right, what interventions need to be used in a particular situation, then you're really looking at the microbiology in a totally different way, right? So luckily, right, the board is also responding to the fact that memorization is not the answer. So most of the board exam is catered to problem solving, right? So how do you derive from whatever way you learn the knowledge to come to the solution is really independent, right? So instead of memorization and understanding the application, which are the first three steps in so-called the learning pyramid, we will go all the way to the next three levels, all the way to creativity, okay? So if we can prepare our students so that they can do very, very well in the boards, but at the same time, prepare them so that they can actually be encouraged to have curiosity and creativity, then, you know, we have a fundamentally different medical education.
What sort of students are you hoping to attract to Carl?
Okay, so the fundamentals first is that in addition to, you know, the traditional pre-med requirements, we will have requirements on the quantitative science. So all the incoming students would have to have high-level mathematics, have some knowledge in computer science, and also statistics. But fundamentally, we're actually looking for four different qualities, right? We call them the four C's. One is compassion, and the second is competence, and then the curiosity and also creativity. I think compassion and competence is generally accepted as the most fundamental requirements of being a physician, but curiosity and creativity are not qualities that are being stressed, right, in traditional medical education. In fact, there's a saying in medicine that you see one, you do one, and you teach one, right, which is very much an apprenticeship system. At the same time, you typically don't challenge the so-called standard of practice. But the way we structure our curriculum, every student in a required clinical rotation will be required to come up with a new idea to change things. So they're encouraged to challenge the existing paradigm. And to help them, we have engineering rounds where the students will be exposed to engineering faculty conditions at the same time to bounce their new ideas around. So by the time they finish the rotation, they should have a very, very well-developed idea that they can present. And out of all these new ideas, one will be selected for their capstone project, which in the fourth year, they will be asked to take the idea all the way to a prototype. And to do that, they will be a leader of a team of other students. And we have sign-up sheets across the campus for other students from other colleges. And our medical students would actually select a team and lead that team to take an idea to prototype. So it can be a software program, it can be a new device, and so on. But, you know, this is built into our curriculum so that our students will become hopefully well-trained physician innovators rather than just traditionally trained physicians.
So when one of those students develops the next multi-billion dollar device, who owns the patents to that?
That's still undergoing consideration, but clearly the student will have some ownership.
Yeah. It's always a question at the top of my mind because I went to the University of Florida where Gatorade was developed, and it's always this ongoing joke that the poor guy that developed Gatorade was an employee of the university, so the university got most of that money.
Well, I think now the patent, the intellectual property rules are very well established, so a lot of the rewards actually go to the inventors.
Yeah. It sounds exciting, but you mentioned something about the classes that you're going to expect a student to have. And as you're searching for your first class, which you're hoping to fill immediately, basically for next year, for August of 2018, what if there's a student out there listening to this going, this is exactly what I hoped to do as a physician, but they don't have those higher level mathematical classes because they never realized they needed them?
Well, so we actually don't stress particular courses as long as you can demonstrate that you have the ability to do it. Then we will discuss with you how we you know can assess you in a way that may not exclude you from our program.
Okay, very interesting. It sounds like that sort of outlook is more of a competency-based outlook. Is that what you're hoping when you're grading medical students and determining if they're ready to move on to the next phase? Are you hoping for a competency-based evaluation?
Absolutely. So just to give you a flavor of how we will deliver our curriculum, so we, of course, have a lot of ideas of leveraging engineering and technology also in our medical education. So the mode of learning will be case-driven, problem-based, active learning. So our students will be divided into 8 students in a group, and they will be asked to solve cases together. And so, you know, in the case format, we can throw in a lot of different elements, not just the basic science, not just the engineering, not just the clinical science, but also even a social and humanistic elements. For example, if a patient can't even have enough money to fill a prescription, so how do you going to treat this particular patient, right? And you can throw in a lot of this type of complexity in that. And to actually enhance the ability of our students gaining competence, we will use a lot of simulation. So I think a lot of medical schools have used a simulation both in using actors, actresses as patients and building, right, physical simulation rooms. So you have rooms that built, like inpatient wards or outpatient clinics and ICUs and emergency rooms, and use mannequins for practice and so on. I think, of course, we have that. We're building a jump simulation center for physical simulation. But the second and third level of simulation is not widely used. Second level is called cognitive simulation, essentially video games, right? Imagine building video games that are part of the case. So you are learning heart failure, then I can give many different types of scenarios of heart failure, patients with diabetes, other social disease, or more simplistic cases. And the students would have to do the right treatment, and then they will be scored immediately, just like any video game, right? So that way they can gain the competence of treating diseases instead of seeing real patients, right? Just like pilots learn how to fly planes now. Instead of flying the real plane, they fly the simulator first for many hours. So this is similar. And the third level is the most exciting, is the virtual reality and augmented reality world, right? That you can do simulation in that world. And we're also building programs that allow us to actually transport, right, students and instructors into this virtual reality world and do simulations there. So that way, right, you can see our students can gain competence a lot faster using this type of approach. At the same time, we will also give our students basic so-called knowledge training using personalized interactive online training. So if you give a lecture, then you have to cater to every person in the room. Usually you go down to the lowest denominator, common denominator. But in a personalized online approach, we give you assessment and say, hey, what do you know and what do you don't know? After the assessment, we can give you a number of modules that we feel that you need. And after doing those modules, of course, you get assessed again. If you still don't know the stuff, then you go back to do the modules. But if you're so smart that you can test out of all the modules, then you can accelerate your progress, right? That would free our students up to actually explore their interests and explore using curiosity and creativity much sooner than even their clinical years. So built into all this is a lot of free time, right? So the number of contact hours is typically less than 25 hours per week. So, you know, if they can learn the basic material and you know, go through those contact hours and still have free time, they are free to explore both in the university and in the Cal Health system to find interesting projects they can do.
Wow.
And so we want it to be very personalized and very tailored and give our students a lot of freedom.
You were talking about the small groups and more of the problem-based learning, and that's something that we do here at the University of Colorado, where I teach a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The small groups here are led by a physician who's gone through the standard medical school curriculum, which hasn't changed in forever. How are your small groups being led to encourage more of that engineering, more of that technological discussion as well?
Right. So in fact, the cases, every case is built by engineer, the basic scientist, and a clinician. So the material include everything. And of course, the medical humanities is also put into as a horizontal track. And we actually have full-time professional facilitators that are trained to actually bring out the different aspects of the case. It's not just the clinical aspects, but engineering aspects and the basic science aspects and the humanistic aspects. So we actually have full-time facilitators instead of having physicians come in, you know, for a few sessions at a time. We are hiring full-time professionals to do that. And of course, you know, we will train up other people to learn from them along the way so that we can actually have a much bigger group of facilitators later on. But in the first phase, we will have full-time facilitators.
Wow, that sounds great. When you're looking at where you want your graduates to have an impact in medicine, where are you hoping they go? What are you hoping they do?
This is a very common question. And first, all of our graduates will be well-trained to move on into traditional residency and become very competent physicians. But because of the tremendous background that they have, some of them may choose to go into other areas, including policy, including administration, including NGOs, and so on. And of course, industry. So we don't really try to, you know, groom them into any particular direction. The only thing we would assess is whether they make positive impacts, right? So what we hope that we can say, 10, 20 years from now, is that our graduates actually will hit the entire spectrum of healthcare delivery, and all of them, and becoming fantastic physician innovators and physician leaders. And if that's the case, we'll be very satisfied. So to answer you directly, we actually don't legislate any particular path for them. And to bring home the point that we will give them exposure 360 degree of our healthcare industry. Every week, we have actually 2 hours of blue sky interactive sessions where we'll invite a representative from every part of the healthcare industry to come and do something like a TED Talk and then have discussions with our students so that they would be open up to exposure to really the entire healthcare industry in 360 degrees. And then, they can choose whatever they excite them, right, and go into that. So we are very deliberate in trying to make our students really as broadly trained as possible.
I wish that was something, as I went through my traditional medical school training and talking to a lot of physicians now, we're not exposed to enough out there because we're so focused on the core sciences and getting good grades on our steps that we're missing out on unlearning about healthcare.
So absolutely. But remember the way we were assessed, right? A lot of it is in the lower level of the learning pyramid. Mm-hmm. A lot of memorization, understanding, and at most application, right? We are never assessed really whether we can go into the last three phases, which is evaluation, analysis, and creativity. And in our curriculum, we want to take our student all the way to the peak of that learning pyramid.
At the end of the day, how will you judge whether or not Carl has done a good job training its students?
Well, the feedback, right, is most important. The feedback from our students, the feedback from all the people that interact with our students at Carl, and then lastly, right, the feedback from the people that interact with our graduates, no matter what path they choose, right? Imagine they go into a traditional residency and the residency director say, wow, you know, your students are so different and they are definitely a catalyst of change. At the same time, they are as competent as anyone trained anywhere else. Then we will agree that our program together with Carl is satisfying really the needs of our students. But at the same time, you know, if we find that there are some weaknesses in our program, then we'll be changing it almost real time. So in fact, we're working with our College of Education to really look at a lot of different monitoring and assessment techniques that will allow us to actually make changes very quickly, rather than waiting years, right, to find out that there are deficiencies in the program.
One of the questions that comes up a lot for new schools with pre-meds is they hear that the school is only preliminarily accredited. How do you assure a student that wants to apply to Carl? How do you assure them that they should get over that fear and take the chance in a new school?
Well, first, you know, this name is, I would say, is almost a misnomer. So in the LCME point of view, any student that get accepted into a program that have preliminary accreditation status will be guaranteed that they can take the board exam and eventually become a board certified physician. So that's the one thing that prospective students need to know, is that once they get into this program, they're guaranteed that they would go all the way. Okay? So it's not like, oh, well, you know, would they be shut down by the LCME in 2 years or whatever? That's not true, right? Mm-hmm. So they will be guaranteed that they will be able to sit for the boards. The second thing is, you know, anyone that study how LCME actually goes through the accreditation process, is very, very rigorous. In fact, I would say that as far as I know, there's no schools that have received preliminary accreditation that have failed to actually eventually be fully accredited. And all the accredited, fully accredited schools, even those that have been put on probation, almost none have actually lost accreditation, right? So I would say that achieving preliminary accreditation usually means that we have a fantastic chance of just moving down the chain if you look at past records.
And the Carl Illinois College of Medicine received its preliminary accreditation recently, and you're ready to accept your first class for 2018. How many students are you looking to accept, and what's the process for you guys for accepting these new students?
We are recruiting for a class of 32 students. And they can go through the regular MCAS process. So we should be showing up in MCAS very soon. And they can just go through the regular MCAS process. And there's another thing I think prospective students need to know, is that we're raising money to give the entire first class 4 years full scholarships. That means that everyone in our inaugural class would have a free medical education. So it's a tremendously attractive proposition for any prospective students. And we're really looking for students that can help us really co-develop this program so that it can be the best of the best. So we are looking for students who have the innovative drive and also entrepreneurial spirit to come in and actually help develop this revolutionary medical education curriculum together with us.
So I've been through the process already, but since it's free tuition, can I apply again? It sounds like a great opportunity.
Yeah, right. I think a lot of people that heard about this are excited. I mean, personally, I would have applied to something like this, right, if that was available to me at the time. So anyone who is really interested in leveraging engineering and technology to change the world of healthcare, I think this is really the place for them. And I guarantee you that they will have a very different education, and we will pour enough personal care and and really help them develop to be the person they want to be you know, we don't do cookie cutter type of training. We will always be small classes. So we hope to grow to 64 in a class, and that's the maximum we'll go, because we want it to be high quality personalized experience for every one of our students.
King, is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure the student knows?
I think another major aspect that is different in our school is that most medical schools, in fact, almost all medical schools, hire full-time faculty into the College of Medicine. So, but in our comprehensive university, we already have so many experts in so many fields. We are leveraging across the board to get the best of the best from every college. And for example, in our first 125 faculty, they come from 9 different colleges and also at Cal. So that way, you know, we can actually dynamically change the expertise and the quality of our faculty almost on the fly. So that's another innovative aspect of our College of Medicine. And another thing is we're also developing a very innovative research program that is mirrored to the medical education program to revolutionize the way we do biomedical research. So our students will be exposed to some really fundamentally different thinking also in the biomedical research world.
When a student who graduates from Carl, at the end of her career, she's looking back at her career, what do you want her to remember Carl by, the education that she got at Carl that left that impact on her career?
Right. I wish they would say, that place opened my mind. Okay. So because no matter how good your education is, or the techniques or the knowledge you learn will become old and obsolete. But, you know, if someone can open your mind and make you become a better person, I think that's the most lasting effect. So if graduates can look back and say, hey, this is really a life-changing experience that opened my mind, and I think that will be a very rewarding thing for anyone involved in education.
All right, so there you have it again. That was Dr. King Lee with the Carl Illinois College of Medicine in Champaign, Illinois. If you want more info, go to medicine.illinois.edu. If you are local to the area, or you can travel on October 21st and November 18th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Carl Illinois College of Medicine will have 2 showcases, again, October 21st and November 18th, to give prospective students the chance to see firsthand what the Carl Illinois experience will be like. You'll meet the dean and leadership and faculty, and you'll explore the many facets of the program that await the first class in July. As of this recording, the AMCAS application is not available yet. Keep checking back. Follow AMCAS on Twitter. Keep checking back on the AMCAS website. As soon as the school is available in AMCAS, send in your application. Again, Carl Illinois College of Medicine accepting 32 students for their first class to start in July of 2018. And all 32 students will be on a full ride 4-year scholarship. Amazing opportunity to be one of the first students, or to be the first students at a new medical school, hoping to change the way medicine is taught in this country. If I had to do it all over again, I would jump at this chance to apply to Carl Illinois. It sounds like an amazing opportunity and an amazing team of people there to lead the way. All right, that's all I have for you this week. Stay tuned next week. We have another great episode coming your way. Have a great week. We'll see you next time here on MedEd Media and the Pre-Med Years.